After last year's symposium, Sarah Atwood, Jim Spates, and Gray Brecken very generously gave me this wonderful antique broadside. Jim had turned it up at an antique shop in New York. It was produced by Elbert Hubbard's Roycroft Community, part of the enduring legacy of the arts and crafts movement founded on the ideals of John Ruskin and William Morris. We are endeavoring to separate intellect and manual labor, it says. We want one man to be always thinking and another to be always working. And we call one a gentleman and the other an operative. Whereas the workman ought often to be thinking and the thinker often to be working. And both should be gentlemen in the best sense. As it is, we make both ungentle, the one envying, the other despising his brother. And the mass of society is made up of morbid thinkers and miserable workers. The quote, hand-printed on handmade paper with a Roycroft watermark, is from Ruskin's The Nature of Gothic, which Clive Willmer will be speaking on later today. My own remarks place emphasis on the second and generally overlooked part of that title, and herein of the true functions of the workman in art. And the actual piece is up here. To present it to me, Jim very kindly had it framed by a conventional frame shop. But on giving it to me, he pretty much commanded me to reframe it. So he won't mind if I take the opportunity to make an example of the frame that was on it. A standard, mass-produced, prefab molding, nailed together, what I call a dead frame. Sorry. You don't know how much I've been worrying about how that was going to come across. To demonstrate for you the debased state of one of the lesser arts and contrast it with how it might be done right, with sound materials, sound joinery, and the application of the very ideals expressed in the quote, the restoration, if you will, of the human spirit to one of the many, many arts all but lost to industrial commerce. For you will hear echoes of Ruskin's words in the mission statement of my frame-making workshop, Holton Studio Framemakers. To revive the art and craft of frame-making by restoring its roots and basis in the art of the joiner, the cabinet maker, the woodwright, in the inspiration of nature and the beauty of its materials, and in the instincts, imagination, and intelligence of the craftsman, to design and make frames the best we can, and so to provide for our customers and serve the true mission of art, to bring beauty to the home and to everyday life. It's a mission against what Morris called makeshift, a mission to restore the vital roots of a once noble art form now largely dead, a mission I carry on alongside Trevor Davis, my brother-in-arms for 16 years now, in holy warfare against the modern framing industry, and ably supported by Karen Gorman and Tom Decker. Our motto, which sums up this mission, is reviving the art and craft of framemaking. So for 20 years, my shops made every frame from scratch, that is, with solid hardwoods such as oak, walnut, cherry, mahogany, and maple, and with each frame starting from rough lumber. Can I get just a little bit more light up here, Tom? As I said, ably supported by Tom Decker. My eyes aren't what they used to be. So we make our frames from rough lumber, designing the frame, as we say, to the picture, shaped and finished to be in harmony with and alive to the picture. Sometimes the designs are simple, sometimes more complex. And the central concern of the joiner's art, joining the frame, not with nails or other metal fasteners, but with real tried and true woodworker's joints. This is Trevor. In the frame I made for the Roycroft broadside, I want to point out three things. The wood, which is that old peasant wood, oak. We use American quarter sawn white oak. Secondly, the carved design, alive to the forms in the print and reflecting my own care for it and its message, a measure of the invention, the workman thinking, commended by the Ruskin quote. And third, this is how it all goes together, with pinned mortise and tenon joints, the age-old strongest method of joining two pieces of wood. When we build, Ruskin tells us in The Seven Lamps of Architecture, Jim Spates' topic, let us think that we build to last.
I hope you all appreciate it.
before you get here. Yes. Let us think that we build. When we build, let us think that we build to last. And here's a new frame. As I said, it's up here next to the fireplace. Enduring timeless ideals deserve an enduring place and setting. So do enduring well-made works by our forebears and handcrafts. So do valued acts of generosity by our living friends. Which means, above all, make your joints strong. Mind your joinery, else valuable things fall apart.
Can we sharpen the focus?
I don't know. Is James... I think Bruce is going to come in. Bruce, did you hear the summons? We're wondering if we can sharpen the focus.
Give it a shot.
Thank you. Was that, did you mean about the slides or my talk?
Yeah.
Oh. When is he going to get around to Ruskin and Morris? You can see well enough for me to carry on, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I think Bruce is on it. Okay.
Tim, tell me when you think it's good.
Oh. You tell Fred? Good? Okay. It's gone off again, Bruce. Bruce, it's gone off again, apparently.
Say what?
It's gone off again. It's not sharp. Yes, which means, above all, make your joints strong, mind your joinery, else valuable things fall apart, as conventional frames will, in short order.
That's good.
That's not one you need to see very well. Okay. And, oh. And here's my reframing in a suitably simple and restrained but more lively frame, alive to the print, and expressing my admiration for it. And I offer it as framing the theme of my talk, the central theme, I argue, for Ruskin and Morris, which is work. Productive labor, the making that sustains life, that builds true civilization, that puts things together. It's the key theme Clive Wilmer wrote of in a recent poem, speaking of Ruskin's, quote, visionary pages, how we work, how we once worked, and how we might come to work, unquote. It's the problem of an age out of joint. But I want you to hear more of this central idea as expressed in the nature of Gothic, to see how powerfully it troubles Ruskin. We have much studied and much perfected of late the great civilized invention of the division of labor, only we give it a false name. It is not, truly speaking, the labor that is divided, but the men, divided into mere segments of men, broken into small fragments and crumbs of life, so that all the little piece of intelligence that is left in a man is not enough to make a pin or a nail, but exhausts itself in making the point of a pin, or the head of a nail. And the great cry that rises from all our manufacturing cities, louder than their furnace blast, is that we manufacture everything there except men. We blanch cotton and strengthen steel, refine sugar and shape pottery, but to brighten, to strengthen, to refine, or to form a single living spirit never enters into our estimate of advantages. After the nature of Gothic, Ruskin never takes his eye off this issue, and though he doesn't stop discussing art and its degradation, increasingly it becomes nearly synonymous with the nature and the modern conditions of labor. And the nature of Gothic touches Morris as a student at Oxford profoundly, so it is also the point, if we had to choose one, where Ruskin and Morris's lives and aims are joined. So I'll be framing it from the point of view of a living art form that I insist on treating as an art of joinery in not only the strictest, but the widest and most significant sense of the word. Most people are pretty sure they see what it is about Ruskin and Morris that appeals to me, a certain pig-headed, anti-modern refusal to let go of folksy ways of doing things, a certain nostalgic and romantic outlook, a baffling attachment to my hands that brands me as a Luddite, and in the digital age, more or less disconnected from and irrelevant to the world. And what's with the picture frames? Who cares about those? Even more, who cares how they're joined? Haven't most people figured out by now that the best rule is the less framing, the better? Why go to so much trouble? A white mat and the thinnest, plainest frame possible, simple strips on the canvas edge, or nothing at all. Let the painting speak for itself without any frame, which, after all, provides nothing but, quote, only so much eye-catching fluff, according to the curator of the Museum of Modern Art, who in the 1980s removed all the frames from the collection's paintings. Yes, the question you might well have in mind right now is the one perhaps most Victorians had for Ruskin and Morris. Will you join the age or won't you? Well, that's a very interesting question, and a question that has everything to do with my task today, to frame Ruskin and Morris. Were they men who simply wouldn't join the age and only wasted their years pining for the Middle Ages? Did they have anything to say to future times, to us? We'll see. We'll see how they appear in the frame I have to make. But that'll be a very big frame, so I'd better get started. Now, I've been talking about this basis of my work in the joiner's art, but I've recently discovered that I shouldn't assume an American audience will know what a joiner and even joinery are. Because according to Wikipedia, and in light of what I've just said, we shouldn't be surprised, quote, the terms joinery and joiner are obsolete in the USA. So, to explain, a joiner, still called in England, is what we all would usually call a woodworker, a maker of cabinets and furniture, like this William Morris table with its very sound joinery, inclusive of everything from cradle to coffin, as you gather from Mr. Midgley's sign, as well as house fixtures, doors, windows, and the like, and even wheels that are put together with the durable joinery of mortise and tenon, dovetails, splines, tongue and groove, and so on. A joiner makes pieces like this bookcase. And I was going to bring this bookcase, but it's not as portable as it should be, I guess. You'll find out, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You bear with me. It's not a bad thing for it not to be portable. It sounds odd, but you'll understand in a minute. Okay, a joiner makes pieces like this bookcase, which has 90 mortise and tenon joints, and he might even turn the chisel used to cut his joints to the even more pleasurable work of carving some decorative semblance of the beauty of nature on the piece. In my home, it also holds many of my own favorite books, including Ruskin and Morris, and including Morris's story about a joiner, Pilgrims of Hope. And so it is personally emblematic of the ideal of a life well-joined, the workman who's often thinking, the workman who designed and made this bookcase for his books being me. I made it at the outset of my business more than 20 years ago, and so it also stands for the basis of our frames and the whole tradition of frames we make, a tradition called cabinet makers' frames. From the point of view of Ruskin and Morris, a bookcase is a very significant type of furnishing. Morris said that his, quote, idea of the fittings necessary to the fitting room of a healthy person includes, first, a bookcase with a great many books in it. Ruskin identified books as one of the five kinds of valuable materials, being vessels containing so much of that kind of real wealth that is cultural heritage, a kind of great community that is ours to join if only we make the effort. Quote, there is a society, he wrote in Of King's Treasuries, continually open to us, of people who will talk to us as long as we like, whatever our rank or occupation, talk to us in the best words they can choose and of the things nearest their heart. And this society can be kept waiting round us all day long. Kings and statesmen lingering patiently, not to grant audience, but to gain it. In those plainly furnished and narrow ante rooms are bookcase shelves. So bookcases have some significance for Ruskin and Morris, but what you're still wondering, do picture frames really have to do with them? Well, the art of the frame maker is a matter, I assure you, needing your very best consideration. But don't take that from me. Let us instead take John Ruskin from the bookcase shelf and let him talk to us of things nearest to his heart. In 1872, the year he founded the Guild of St. George, Ruskin opened an Oxford lecture called the relation of engraving to the other arts of Florence by telling a story brimming with our theme. He set his topic in the context of a singularly important, quote, space of 40 years between 1480 and the year in which Raphael died, 1520. Within that space of time, the change was completed from the principles of ancient to those of existing art. Ruskin called the epoch-defining moment in history, quote, the great transition from ancient to modern habits of thought, a manifold change of broader societal consequences and concern than the relatively narrow, rarefied realm of art, as his listeners would have understood it, the realm occupied by the famous painters, sculptors, and architects who were the main cast of characters in the story Ruskin was telling. He was asked, for example, how Botticelli and Holbein, Giotto, Perugino, and Michelangelo achieved their great standing in history. Quote, who taught them what they were finally best to teach? How far must every people teach its masters before they could teach it? This idea, what we'd call the great man theory of history, is wrong. No idea, he stated firmly, can be more superficial. Every nation must teach its tutors and prepare itself to receive them, men whose singular gifts suddenly melt the multitude already at the point of fusion. Such state of civic and artistic cohesion obtains in Florence, he explains, 300 years before the great transition. In other words, the true flourishing of Florence begins not with the Renaissance, as we've been taught, but centuries prior. Around 1200, a true conscientious and didactic art, as he calls it, is born out of the great joining, the great mixing of the cold art of the Norman North and, quote, hot art of the Byzantine South. In the Val d'Arno, quote, the northern and southern nations meet and lay down their enmities, and the meeting is vital. At that moment, quote, men awake as if they heard an alarm through the whole vault of heaven, and true human life begins again. This great era of uncorrupted Christianity is marked by the building of the Cathedral and Baptistry of Florence. But again, although these are high achievements, Ruskin identifies their living roots and foundation in the popular art, the vernacular art of Florence. This is a civically embedded art, entirely devoted to the civic life of the people. But in the great transition of about 1500, the point we've been taught, at which civilization rises to exemplary achievement and fulfillment, this conscientious, unified, and vernacular place of art is in fact betrayed. A great division takes place as the fine artists separate themselves from and turn with disdain on their teachers and perpetual helpers, ordinary artisans, and the life of the populace. At that time, at the same time, they turn on their older masters. Emblematic of this betrayal, Ruskin says, is Michelangelo's, quote, epithet bestowed on Perugino, dunce or blockhead. Dunce or blockhead in art. The most cruel, the most false, and the most foolish insult ever offered by one great man to another, but one at least providing us a clear understanding of, quote, how trenchant the separation is between the two orders of artists. And in his story of this division and separation follows as a direct consequence the disunion of the arts. With a carefully composed timeline, Ruskin painstakingly charts his story and sums up its meaning. Among the artists of 1300, quote, four of the five men are architects as well as sculptors and painters. In the 1400 group, there is one architect. In the 1500, none. And the meaning of that is that in 1300, the arts were all united and duly led by architecture. In 1400, sculpture began to assume too separate a power to herself. In 1500, painting arrogated all and at last betrayed all, from which, with much other collateral evidence, you may justly conclude that the three arts ought to be practiced together and that they naturally are so. Exemplifying the old unified art, Ruskin says, is the Campanile of Florence, Giotto's, quote, bell tower to ring all over the town when they are either to pray together, rejoice together, or be warned of danger. That's the civically embedded art I was talking about. And in his discourse on the art of engraving, the Campanile is also, Ruskin says rather wonderfully, one piece of large engraving. So he connects it to the whole scope of that art, from the first human scratches on cave walls, to the furrows in the farmer's fields, to Holbein's depictions of melancholia to the modern corruptions of the art, cheap prints made for mass consumption, to our final engraved resting place in the earth, dug by the lights of our friend Mr. Midgley, the joiner. And then Ruskin does what he does repeatedly and so well. He teaches us to read a building, and this time to drive home his point and take us to the climax of his story. I made a sketch when last in Florence, he says, of a subject which will fix the idea of this unity of the arts in your minds. At the base of the Tower of Giotto are two rows of hexagonal panels. He's misremembering, there's actually one row of hexagonal panels at the very bottom, filled with bas-reliefs. These depict the Genesis and the arts. And you see that the arts here include not only fine arts, but those of building, weaving, metalsmithing, agriculture, and so forth. Some of these, he continues, are by unknown hands, some by Andrea Pisano, some by Luca della Robbia, two by Giotto himself. Of these, I sketched the panel representing the art of painting. You have in the bas-relief one of the foundation stones of the most perfectly built tower in Europe. You have that stone carved by its architect's own hand. You find further that this architect and sculptor was the greatest painter of his time and the friend of the greatest poet, Dante, and you have represented by him a painter in his shop as symbolic of the entire art of painting, in which representation, please note how carefully Giotto shows you the tabernacles or niches in which the paintings are to be placed, not independent of their frames, these panels of his you see. And finally, his curious revelation of the meaning of this image, supposedly representative of the art of painting, but nearly half of which is occupied by an empty picture frame. Have you considered in the early history of painting how important also is the history of the frame maker? It is a matter, I assure you, needing your very best consideration. For the frame was made before the picture. The painted window is much, but the aperture it fills was thought of before it. The fresco by Giotto is much, but the vault it adorns was planned first. Who thought of these? Who built? Questions taking us far back before the birth of Giotto, the shepherd boy of Fiesole. Questions not to be answered by history of painting only, still less of painting in Italy only. And in pointing out to you this fact, I may once for all prove to you the essential unity of the arts and show you how impossible it is to understand one without reference to another. Now, the point of this long buildup was not to construe Ruskin's authority to convince you of how important picture frames are over and above other arts, including the fine arts like painting, far from it. My object with this lecture of Ruskin's is to show you what Ruskin is showing us by pointing to a great Florentine artist's noble representation of an art form that by Ruskin's own time and for his audience is widely denigrated. The picture frame is emblematic of his point. The outstanding feature of a vital civilization, which is the unity of its arts and the foundation of all the arts on the popular arts, led by and subordinate to architecture, the art he called the work of the whole race. This is a major part of Ruskin's teaching, and is well learned by Morris, who describes the foundation of all art to be the art of the people, expressed primarily in, quote, this, and this is Morris, it is this union of the arts, mutually helpful and harmoniously subordinated to another, which I have learned to think of as architecture. A great subject, truly, for it embraces the consideration of the whole external surroundings of the life of man. We cannot escape from it if we would, so long as we are part of civilization, for it means the molding and altering to human needs of the very face of the earth itself. But the role and significance of the frame in such profound and all-encompassing subjects? Words borrowed from modern painters sum up the point in his lecture on medieval Florence, Ruskin's lecture, and Giotto's curious juxtaposition of the arts of painting and frame making. Quote, do not think I am irreverently comparing great things and small. The system of the world is entirely one. Small things and great are alike part of one mighty whole. That one mighty whole being what he calls in the lecture on Florence, the vital craftsmanship of the world. This is not a conventional narrative. Ruskin digs deep into history to gather and assemble the materials for a radically unconventional window on art history, a radically more humble frame for art than the pretentious and isolating frames displayed at the eminently established and insular place of art, the Royal Academy. His audience would have been no less surprised than we are to have been led by the lecturer to the climax of a story about great exemplary art, an art leading up to the Renaissance, for goodness sake, only to be offered not the queen of the arts, the art of geniuses, painting, but the queen's servant, the frame on the painting. Who gives a damn about the frame? Who'd go to the Royal Academy to look at the frames? What kind of art history is this? And this frame's not even yet on the painting. It's an empty thing. The art of an ordinary unknown craftsman, or very possibly the medieval painter himself, still humble enough to consider the frame worthy of his efforts. Ruskin's history is what's often called a competing narrative to the conventional narrative about that central issue I said belongs at the center of our frame, work, what it's been, what it is, what it might be. This contrast of choices between narratives of civilization, between ways the world might go, is the essence of Ruskin's great lecture, The Two Paths, in which he contrasts living art versus dead conventional art. It's also reflected in the title of Morris's How We Live and How We Might Live. Ruskin gave a name to this story of the dunces of Florence, gathering place of uncouth wandering Goths, hayseed shepherd boys, and no-count picture frame makers. He called it the Florentine Dunciad, or History of Fools. With apologies to one of the greatest prose writers in the English language, I prefer another title and one that sums up my frame for Ruskin and Morris, The Joiner's Tale. Because, as you can see, the really remarkable and significant aspect of this competing narrative is that, in this great reframing of art, in his story, in its language of relation, gathering, fusion, mixing, connecting, of unity, Ruskin joins the world. And so he has an answer to the great problem at the center of our frame, the problem of denigrated and divided labor. The conventional wisdom was, we are fallen creatures, we are condemned to the curse of toil, 'twas always thus. Ruskin says, no, 'twas not always thus. To the contrary, the unity of the arts of society is essential and natural to vital human civilization. And the most salient characteristic of dead and dying civilizations is their disunity. Labor may be our redemption, not the price of sin and separation, but the means of our reunion and joining in creation. So in addition to the problem of work at the center of our frame is the active effort on the part of Ruskin and Morris to solve this problem. We are framing, that is to say, a narrative painting. Ruskin and Morris working and working with a great human spirit on that object of the problem of labor. I hope the quotes I've provided give you a sense of the thing in them that they so worried about in the ordinary workman, a longing to join the world, and in their case, an extraordinarily powerful longing. While Ruskin was primarily a joiner in his view and teaching, Morris was one in reality, being not least of all a weaver, plainly a brother to the joiner. In the very first biography of Morris, J.W. McHale wrote that, quote, the whole of Morris's extraordinary powers are devoted towards no less an object than the reconstitution of the civilized life of mankind. And Morris's protean powers, fed by this animating human joiner spirit, is gained in great part from Ruskin, chiefly through the nature of Gothic, and joins the two in 19th century social and design at reform. It is a spirit and instinct that guides nearly every letter, essay, letter, lecture, and book, and finally, deed, for that is what joining is in their lives, and that is what I believe makes their ideas extremely significant to our own deeply divided and alienated age. If we had time, I would obey Ruskin's advice and give the history of the framemaker our very best consideration and show you what becomes of it as a joiner's art. I can show you the original place of art, and the contrast with all that follows will give you most of the idea. Last year, Jim Spates spoke about this mural that's pictured on the cover of an edition of Clive's Ruskin anthology. It's Lorenzetti's fresco, Good Government, in the Palazzo Pubblico in Siena. The first paintings were murals. Morris says at one time nearly every house in Europe had some decorations painted on the walls, not of course all this great as this. Thoroughly decorative or applied works of art and subordinate along with all the other arts to the whole building, to the mother art of architecture. Treating painting as a decorative art may sound to you like a terrible constraint to place on it, nearly sacrilegious. But Ruskin says, get rid then at once of any idea of decorative art being a degraded or a separate kind of art. Its nature or essence is simply its being fitted for a definite place, and in that place forming part of a great and harmonious whole in companionship with other art. And so far from this being a degradation to it, so far from decorative art being inferior to other art, because it is fixed to a spot, on the whole, it may be considered as rather a piece of degradation that it should be portable. Portable art, independent of all place, is for the most part ignoble art. And that's why I didn't bring my bookcase today. And look what's in the lap of the seated figure in the foreground. This noble art is not above recognizing the significance of a simple hand plane, one of the basic tools of a joiner, and not a bad social tool, a tool for leveling and concord. It says Concordia across it. But murals are scarce today. We can hardly conceive of painting as anything other than a portable art. Clearly, then, the picture frame occupies very troubled territory, an area in great tension, as Ruskin described in The Nature of Gothic. Quote, "All good architecture is, more than any other subject of art, the work of man and the expression of the average power of man. A picture or poem is often little more than a feeble utterance of man's admiration of something out of himself. But architecture approaches more to a creation of his own, born of his necessities and expressive of his whole nature. It is also, in some sort, the work of the whole race, while the picture or statue are the work of one only, in most cases more highly gifted than his fellows." And with more time, I'd be able to show you how this tension plays out, how we may read in the architecture of the picture frame over the past centuries the story and effort of the frame to either help pictures or to fail them, to either connect or isolate pictures from their architectural settings, to either help people see the painting or simply exhibit and show off the painting, to help people enjoy the painting as part of their daily lives, informing and ennobling their lives, or to treat art as beyond them in every way. But I want to keep my frame on Ruskin and Morris, and since I took Ruskin from the shelf to tell us a chapter of the Joiner's Tale, I'll take William Morris from the bookcase shelf to tell you one of his. I do want to preface this, though, by pointing out that in the Joiner's Tale, that is the narrative of these two lives, in a real sense, Morris may be said to fulfill or complete Ruskin. Quote, "It would be well if all of us were good handicraftsmen in some kind, and the dishonor of manual labor done away with altogether," Ruskin had said in The Nature of Gothic, and Morris heeded. And he heeded Ruskin's advice, not only informing his own vision for a reconstituted civilization, but he did what was nearly unthinkable for a wealthy Englishman of his day and took up manual labor. That is, he joined the ranks of Michelangelo's dunces. I can't tell you that it happened just this way, but I imagine the moment when Morris, in his Oxford rooms, sets down his volume of The Nature of Gothic, exuberant from discovering a new narrative, new meaning and purpose, and he instinctively turns his own formidable creative powers to channeling the devotional labor and life of one of Ruskin's 13th century masons, picks up a pen himself and writes Story of the Unknown Church, his own Joiner's Tale. "I was the master mason of a church that was built more than 600 years ago. It's an outpouring of love, fraternal love, but also love for history, architecture, our craftsmen, forebears, and redemptive labor. The nature's sister and her husband, the narrator's best friend, meet a tragic end, prompting the mason narrator to carve them not only a tomb, but also a tabernacle around it, and to thus spend his final years making a frame for his memorial." So it happened after I carved those two whom I loved, lying with clasped hands like husband and wife above their tomb, that I could not yet leave carving it. And so that I might be near them, I became a monk. And I used to go to the tomb under the great sweeping arch, and in process of time I raised a marble canopy that reached quite up to the top of the arch. And I painted it too as fair as I could and carved it all about with many flowers and histories. And in them I carved the faces of those I had known on earth. And as I carved, sometimes the monks and other people too would come and gaze and watch how the flowers grew. And sometimes too, as they gazed, they would weep for pity, knowing how all had been. So my life passed, and I lived in that abbey for 20 years after he died, till one morning they found me lying dead with my chisel in my hand underneath the last lily of the tomb. Thank you, William Morris. Now that is a picture frame. Is Topsy over the top? Sure, but what do you expect from a college kid who's just found another reading of history than the accepted one, which was leading civilization to mediocrity, decay, and collapse? And the story does this much for us. It reminds us of how people frame images and ideals they passionately believe in. The loving impulse that produces the sacrifice and conscientious labor of sincere ornament and provides joy and solace. If and when, that is, the art of such things is still alive. Morris's story demonstrates Ruskin's observation that all true art is praise. And if we were to see in this raw college student story a naive and wrong-headed view of what real work is, the rest of Morris's life, the next 40 years, would prove us wrong. 40 years of passionate work in at least 14 different arts, 40 years proving through exuberant work that there may be joy in our labor, 40 years of exuberant affection for humanity, past, present, and future, 40 years at the end of which we can say, with very little exaggeration, he did, after all, die with a chisel in his hands. But to be fair, Morris might have had more restraint. And we can directly blame his teacher, John Ruskin, for his excesses. Morris's imperfect writing, that's nonetheless sincere in its affections and desires, were most likely enabled, as we like to say, by Ruskin's praise in the nature of Gothic, of the exuberantly imperfect medieval carvers of rude gargoyles and statues, and the author's admonition not to mock at those flawed craftsmen, quote, for they are the signs of the life and liberty of every workman who struck the stone, a freedom of thought and rank and scale of being, which it must be the first aim of all Europe at this day to regain for her children. That astonishing celebration of imperfection in work, in art, the opposite of the conventional celebration of artistic perfection, surely served Morris as a spur to his extraordinarily audacious and fearless ambitions in handwork. Morris took for his motto, si je puis, or as I can, or as best I can, a motto that captures the spirit of every true craftsman since the crippled Hephaestus, who accepts and even embraces his imperfect humanity and plunges fearlessly into his task, striving for the best he can do. Morris took for his motto, Morris first saw the motto inscribed in Dutch, Als ich kan, in this 15th century picture frame by Jan van Eyck, one great framemaker you may have heard of, a framemaker not afraid to try his hand at painting, critics be damned. And this motto is also taken up in the U.S. by Gustav Stickley and others, so it might well be called the motto of the whole arts and crafts movement. In this vein, Robert Browning wrote that a man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for? If Morris and Ruskin's reach exceeded their grasp for the tools and materials to rejoin and reconstitute the world, they were only being true to their spirit, the spirit of the conscientious and vital craftsman. The framemaker Jan van Eyck's painting from before the time of Raphael brings us to another intersection between Morris and Ruskin. The Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, whose, quote, conscientious and didactic art, had earned the praise of Ruskin. John Everett Millay, Ford Madox Brown, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, and William Holman Hunt had already been persuaded by Ruskin's competing narrative, as their name indicates, of the great transition that ends with Raphael. Excuse me. And the characteristic of medieval art that most drew their attention was the humility of pictures from the time before, as Ruskin had argued, painting irrigated all. Recalling the origin of the Brotherhood he helped found, Hunt remembered their discovery of a book of medieval prints, and quote, as we searched through this book of engravings, we found in them that freedom from corruption, pride, and disease for which we sought, and here there was at least no trace of decline, no conventionality, no arrogance. But to revive what Ruskin had identified as a conscientious and didactic painting from before the Great Transition, the degraded 19th century frame clearly would not do. And not only pretentiousness, but the whole modern disease of separation, including the ideal of art for art's sake. And I'm realizing this is a little confusing. This is not an example of what I'm talking about. This is another example similar to, this is Robert Campin, 14th or 15th century, I'm sorry, I'm not sure which. And I'm going to take a second to just point out that on the theme of the unity of art, This early painting is one solid panel. The frame and the painting are one. And it is solid oak. And so he has carved the edges of the panel and recessed the center of the panel for the painting. As the arts and crafts architect M.H. Bailey Scott put it, and you can imagine, you know what frames I'm talking about when I'm contrasting with this, the 19th century pompous big gold frames. As the arts and crafts architect M.H. Bailey Scott put it, it would be interesting to inquire how far the art of picture painting is coincident with the decline of art in its widest interpretation, representing the last stronghold of the artist driven from the service of life behind the gilded pale of the picture frame, where he dreams in a little shadow world all his own. The whole point of the wide and arbitrary pompous gold frame used for 19th century painting was to isolate pictures and separate the fine arts from the humbler decorative arts and separate the artist from the artisan and from Philistine society. As an obvious and simple first step in restoring the unity of pictures and frames, Bailey Scott recommended that the wood of the frames be that used for the walls the pictures were intended for, ideally oak, the noble wood that had supported and provided the basis for Robert Campin's reverential art. Reforming the place of art means directly reframing art. In his history of the British design reform movement, the first president of the Arts and Crafts Exhibition Society, Walter Crane, dug down to, quote, the real vital germs of the movement. To trace the genesis of our English revival, we must, this is quoting Crane, to trace the genesis of our English revival, we must go back to the days of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. The very marked character of their pictures standing out with almost startling effect from among the works of the older academic school demanded at least a special architecture in the frames of their pictures. And this led to the practice of painters designing their own frames, at least those who were concerned for unity and decorative effect. The architecture of the frames. Pre-Raphaelite frames restored the joiner's art to frame making, and therefore the original architectural quality of the old frames. It had been a long time since frames had been regarded as anything but showy presentation and packaging to sell the painting, a long while since they'd been considered anything so sound and solid as architecture. It had been a long time since painting had humbled itself to, quote, the art of the whole race. But how else to restore the original and true place of painting and the essential unity of the arts? But something else that conventional frames didn't do was to help the picture do the main thing we need pictures for, to show us the world, to make us see. No words from Ruskin were more important to the Pre-Raphaelites than these. Quote, the greatest thing a human soul ever does in this world is to see something and to tell what it saw in a plain way. This, for Ruskin, is a primary root and basis of all the arts, but most of all, pictorial arts we frame. The frame that's alive to the picture not only in some way praises it, it not only connects it to architecture by being a real work of the joiner's art in harmony with the building, it also helps us see the picture, helps, as Morris said, give people back their eyes, and so reconnect us to the world toward which we've become blind and careless. This work of helping the picture is no small matter in the thought of Ruskin and Morris. In fact, Ruskin identifies the very first law of the universe as the law of help. The highest and first law of the universe and the other name of life is help. The other name of death. The other name of death is separation. Government and cooperation are in all things and eternally the laws of life. Anarchy and competition eternally and in all things the laws of death. The law of help and Ruskin's teaching about seeing are so fundamental to the art of the framemaker that I want to underscore it a bit, and as I do, to show you with some before and after shots how we've literally reframed art according to the ideals I just described. These are mostly 19th century landscape paintings inspired, I think it's safe to say, by Ruskin's appeal to painters to see the world truthfully. Morris has a great phrase that I always remember, which is, for beauty's sake and not for show. They're very important words, guiding words for a frame maker. And it's always frustrating when I'm showing my picture, well, even just having a website and showing our work online, I'm always concerned that it's not coming across and you know, it has a present in person. That's why one reason I brought this is the whole point of it is to be subordinate to the picture. It's not supposed to jump out. It's not supposed to draw attention to itself. And so these frames are subtle, and I do hope that they come across. We work hard to make them well, and we use beautiful woods, and their restraint and their subtlety is part of what I love about them. We live in a perpetual deluge of images passing before our eyes, Ruskin says. And especially in a complex world, we desperately need pictorial art to provide order and meaning, to stop the deluge, to say, consider this, this matters. And in this crucial help and service to our lives that pictures provide, the right frame contributes crucial emphasis. The frame underscores and amplifies the message that this matters. And the art of the framemaker reflects this understanding in an art that is, first of all, sound in its workmanship, and second of all, alive to the picture, and sustaining and joining its spirit into the architecture of the room and the lives lived therein. In that way, the frame helps overcome what Morris called the fatal schism between art and life. To this end, the framemaker must see the picture and tell in a real sense what he sees in a plain way, that is, in the humble and always subordinate yet vital frame he makes to deliver the picture to the viewer. I have to confess that although I've been reading Ruskin and Morris for years, until I began preparing this talk, I did not appreciate how heavily Morris's thought draws on Ruskin's, and with frank and effusive credit and praise to his teacher. I want to get through these. There's Trevor. That's an extremely detailed painting. It's very much influenced by Ruskin's ideas of seeing nature truly. Benjamin Williams, Leader, great 19th century Royal Academy painter. William Keith, Thaddeus Welch, frame Trevor designed. I don't do all the design. Trevor does some design. He has a great deal of input even on my design. And so I want to make sure that there's I'm not going to say there's no division of labor whatsoever, and Ruskin wasn't saying there should be no division of labor whatsoever. There's some, but it's but we're very close in both, and I make frames still, and he helps me design. And this is a Thomas Hill. Read that again. I have to confess that although I've been reading Ruskin and Morris for years, until I began preparing this talk, I did not appreciate how heavily Morris's thought draws on Ruskin's, and with frank and effusive credit and praise to his teacher. In one lecture, Morris pauses to say, quote, I should be ashamed of letting you think that I forget the labors of other men on which mine are founded. I know that the pith of what I am saying on this subject was set forth years ago, and for the first time by Mr. Ruskin in On the Nature of Gothic, in words more clear and eloquent than any man else now living could use. So important do they seem to me that to my mind they should have been posted up not only in every school of art throughout the country, but in every association which professes in any way to further the culture of mankind, including the Hillside Club of Berkeley. I added that. And there's a reason he reiterates Ruskin's message. I'm sorry to have to say it. My excuse for doing little more now than repeating those words is that they have been less heeded than most things which Mr. Ruskin has said. I suppose because people have been afraid of them, lest they should find the truth they express sticking so fast in their minds that it would either compel them to act on it or confess themselves slothful and cowardly. Now, he says, nor, he says, should we wonder that people are afraid of such ideas, because the narrative Ruskin composed was real and serious, has real and serious consequences for how we are to find our way out of our troubles. Quote, for if people were once to accept it as true that it is nothing but just and fair that every man's work should have some hope and pleasure always present in it, they might try to bring the change about that would make it so. And all history tells us of no greater change in man's life than that would be. Morris has one great question he puts to his audiences to engage them in the world, to get Ruskin's message to stick to them, and get them to join the great joiner's tale that is the story of civilization. All these good things, will you have them? Will you cast them from you? In other words, while more than a few Englishmen rejected the narrative of the vital significance of the art of the Middle Ages that Morris and Ruskin offered and were tempted to shout back at them, will you join the age or won't you? Morris turned the question on them. Will you join the age or won't you? Will you reconstitute civilization and our place on the earth, or will you continue to let it decay, to divide society and destroy the world? As a complaint against the dehumanization of labor and industrialized conditions, the Nature of Gothic had anticipated Marx's analysis of the alienation of labor. But while Marx and Ruskin had complained about alienated, dehumanized labor, Morris showed what unalienated, humanized labor looks like and what its products look and feel like. He demonstrated and made real what Ruskin had only argued, that through pleasurable and uncompelled labor, we become not divided, we become whole, not divided creatures. It was one thing to talk of the joy in labor, another thing altogether to actually find and experience that joy. But further, by that experience, to know in your soul what a loss, what a thorough, total, catastrophic loss it has been to humanity to have wasted the greater part of its arts and along with that the greater part of human life, condemning it instead to the curse of miserably repetitious, tedious, useless, and meaningless, murderous jobs. Knowing what unalienated labor was, Morris spoke with firsthand knowledge and authority about not simply what was wrong with the world, but how it might be made right. In Ruskin's later life, deep regret sets in regards to the matter of practical action, of materially engaging in the world, of spending too much time instead on composing aesthetically pleasing passages that stopped his affluent readers in their tracks, but also stopped them from pursuing his message on a matter, art, that no one, in any case, seemed to understand or care about anymore. His chapter, The Law of Help, closes with a definition of a maker, a creator, and we may safely call him a joiner, for he is, quote, a person who puts things together in such manner that he, quote, puts life into them. These makers, he says, are not the men of the thought shops or thought manufactories. And there is, in the concluding line, a clear note of regret for his own life as too much the thinker and not enough the worker when Ruskin tells us that, quote, we should not think it strange that the last act of the life of Socrates should have been to purify himself from the sin of having negligently listened to the voice within him, which, through all his past life, had bid him labor and make harmony. But the search for harmony inevitably led Ruskin, as it did Morris, to a search for a new basis of life and society. And in one of my favorite Ruskin essays, The Mystery of Life and Its Arts, he seems to hit on it. He says that on the great mysteries of life, quote, the wise religious men, the wise contemplative men, and the wise worldly men all fail our interrogations and offer only, quote, empty religion. Quote, but there is another group yet. That great group of persons by whom all these disputers live, the persons who have determined that they will do something useful, these hewers of wood and drawers of water, these bent under burdens or torn of scourges, these that dig and weave, that plant and build, workers in wood and in marble and in iron, by whom all food, clothing, habitation, furniture, and means of delight are produced, from these, sure, at least we may receive some clearer message of teaching and pierce for an instant into the mystery of life and of its arts. But I grieve to say, or rather, for that is the deeper truth of the matter, I rejoice to say that this message of theirs can only be received by joining them, not by thinking about them. In light of this, we can fully appreciate the compliment the student finally won from his teacher when Ruskin praised Morris as, quote, the ablest man of his time. Morris celebrated with a bottle of Tokay. Well, I hope my frame helps you to see these two men whom I admire. At the least, I expect you to understand why the frame I've tried to make from Ruskin and Morris is a frame of such praise. For as a framemaker, I view them as real teachers to me because they are themselves, in an only slightly abstract sense, framemakers. For when we frame pictures, we confront, in tangible and immediate form, the whole profound question of the place of art that occupied Ruskin and Morris. And the true place of art is at root in the ordinary work of the craftsman, the joiner, in the greatest sense of the term, one who puts things together, little things like picture frames and big things like civilization. No wonder Ruskin says the art of the framemaker is a matter needing our very best consideration. If you had to choose one art to focus upon to gain Ruskin's understanding of art, you couldn't do better than the art of the picture frame, an art, as I said, entirely devoted to helping, the first law of the universe. But speaking as a framemaker who appreciates a good frame of art by a fellow framemaker, I'd say Morris takes Ruskin's law of help and the nature of Gothic and builds a nearly perfect frame for what art is. He says, "What I mean by art is above all the token of that chief of what chiefly makes life good and not evil, of joy and labor, in creation that is, and this joy and labor, this evidence of man helping in the work of creation, is, I feel sure, the thing from which the first all progress in civilization has been aiming at. Feed this inspiration, and you feed the flame of civilization throughout the world. Extinguish it, and civilization will die also." But what can we do? And really, after all, the world asks, what did Morris achieve? What can one man do with his hands? "Our hands," said Ruskin, "are, quote, the most perfect agents of material power in the universe." And this was only a rediscovery of what the ancient Greek Anaxagoras had realized. It is by having hands that man is the most intelligent of animals. We can't make much, each of us alone. And though they sought to rejoin and reconstitute the world, this they knew. The system of the world is entirely one. Small things and great are alike part of one mighty whole. Thank you.